increasingly monopolistic position as the winner-take-all player in online entertainment. Then there's the impact of the digital revolution on publishing, and by extension, on politics. Our news ecosystem has changed more dramatically in the past 5 years than perhaps at any time in the past 500 years, says Emily Bell, the director of the Tau Center for Digital Journalism at Columbia University's Journalism School. Digital technology, she warns, has actually put the future of publishing into the hands of a few, who now control the destiny of many. Social media, Bell says, have swallowed journalism with what she dubs, with a medieval symbolism that might have amused Erasmus of Rotterdam, the four horsemen of the apocalypse, Google, Facebook, Apple, and Amazon, engaged in a prolonged and torrid war for our attention. These private superpowers are thus becoming our new speech governors, usurping the traditional role of government in determining what can and can't be published. Meanwhile, online publishers, the actual creators of content, and one would assume economic value, remain mired in crisis, with 85% of all online advertising revenue going in the first quarter of 2016 to just two of Tim Berners-Lee's centralized data silos, Facebook and Google. The monopolization of media isn't just a problem for publishers. With Facebook as our new front page on the world, we are simply being refed our own biases by networked software owned by a $350 billion data company that resolutely refuses to acknowledge itself as a media company, because that would require it to employ armies of real people as curators. It would also make Facebook legally liable for the advertising that appears on its network. So, what we see and read on social media, therefore, is what we want to see and read. No wonder everything now seems so inevitable to so many people. This echo chamber effect, the so-called filter bubble, has created a hall of mirrors, a post-truth media landscape dominated by fake news and other forms of online propaganda. Thus, the disturbing success of Trump, Brexit, and the alt-right movement. Thus, the virulence of Putin's troll factories, networked ISIS recruiters, and the other mostly anonymous racists, misogynists, and bullies sowing digital hatred and violence. The 2017 Edelman Trust Barometer captures this deeply troubling connection between the global implosion of trust and the rise of our echo chamber media. The respondents to the Edelman report favored search engines, 59%, over human editors, 41%. And the barometer found that they were nearly four times more likely to disregard online information that supports a position in which they don't believe. The lack of trust in media has given rise to the fake news phenomenon and politicians speaking directly to the masses, warns Richard Edelman. As I predicted in my 2007 book, The Cult of the Amateur, How Today's Internet is Killing Our Culture, the ultimate victim of this supposed democratization of media is the idea of truth itself. Without gatekeepers, fact-checkers or editors able to verify the truth of a newspaper article or television news report, your fake news is as truthful as mine. America now even has a democratically elected president, as every schoolchild knows, the most powerful person in the world, one of the few remaining truths on which everyone, outside Moscow, agrees, who is a product and a dispenser of this corrosive fake news culture. And he's made it abundantly clear that his real enemy is what's left of objective, curated media. Even some of Silicon Valley's most powerful people are finally beginning to recognize the seriousness of this problem. Apple CEO Tim Cook, whose company's business model, unlike those of Google and Facebook, doesn't depend on the sale of its users' data, argues that fake news is killing people's minds. Cook believes that the problem requires public action. Like the campaigns to educate people about our environmental crisis, he says it needs a concerted public effort to educate people on the dangers of fake news. But it's not only fake online news that is killing people's minds. Just as much of the industrially produced food of the mid-20th century was designed to be addictive, So, too, many of today's digital products have been created to hook us on them. There are even best-selling books by Silicon Valley marketers with seductive titles like Hooked that are essentially manuals explaining how to build habit-forming products. One high-profile addict is the Anglo-American blogger and polemicist Andrew Sullivan, a very early adopter of what he calls living in the web, who has admitted attending a meditation retreat center in Massachusetts to kick his digital habit. "I used to be a human being," Sullivan confessed about the consequences of his internet addiction. According to the New York University psychologist Adam Alter, there are many millions of others like Sullivan with what Alter calls a behavioral addiction to our smartphones and our email. In the 1960s, we swam through waters with only a few hooks: cigarettes, alcohol, and drugs that were expensive and generally inaccessible, Alter argues. In the 2010s, those same waters are littered with hooks. There's the Facebook hook, the Instagram hook, the porn hook, the email hook, the online shipping hook, and so on. The list is long, far longer than it's ever been in human history, and we're only just learning the power of these hooks. Just as Tim Cook is calling for public action against fake news, so other Silicon Valley technologists are calling for a similar response against what the San Francisco-based pediatric endocrinologist Robert Lustig calls the hacking of the American mind by Alter's digital hooks. According to the Financial Times' Isabella Kaminska, this hacking is directly undermining our happiness. Despite all the technology that connects us, much of it there supposedly to make our lives easier and better, Kaminska warns about the impact of our digital hooks. People have never been more depressed. A former design ethicist at Google, Tristan Harris, has gone as far as to argue that software developers should sign a code of conduct, a kind of Hippocratic oath, promising to create products that treat their users with respect. Harris, who is the founder of the nonprofit Time Well Spent, and was described by The Atlantic as the closest thing Silicon Valley has to a conscience, believes that there need to be new ratings, new criteria, new design standards, new certification standards to ensure against addictive products. When I interviewed Harris for my TechCrunch TV show, he told me that the three dominant digital platforms of our networked age, Apple, Google, and Facebook, have been explicitly designed to hook our attention. "We all live in a city called the attention economy," Harris argued, citing the work of the urban planning pioneer Jane Jacobs, and suggesting that the challenges of software developers are similar to those of urban planners. "And if this 21st century city is to be habitable," he said, "then these platform owners need to take responsibility for the impact of their products on their users." Can the internet save the world? In The Internet is Not the Answer, I argued that the digital revolution, combined with the network effect of a winner-take-all economy, has created a big tech concentration of power that dwarfs big banks, big oil, or big pharma in its size and significance. "It's a much more lavish meal than just Facebook swallowing journalism," I suggested. Corporations like Google and Facebook were once known rather quaintly as internet companies, but today they are rapidly becoming artificial intelligence companies and self-driving car companies and virtual reality companies. "Software is eating the world," is how Mark Andreessen, the co-founder in 1994 of the first internet browser company, Netscape, and the original boy king of Silicon Valley, describes the way in which networked technology is feeding on almost everything and everyone else. Silicon Valley isn't just the new Wall Street. It's actually wealthier and more powerful than the old Wall Street, outspending the financial industry by 2-1 in Washington, D.C. lobbying during the Obama administration's 8 years. Yes, we've seen this before. It's the reappearance of the same utopian market economy creating the same radical inequalities between rich and poor that have appeared many times before in history. From the enclosures of Thomas More's 16th century English countryside that resulted in sheep devouring men, to the overcrowded industrial tenements of 19th century New York City. But this time, the numbers are even more astonishing. The five most valuable companies on the Fortune 500 list, the four horsemen of the apocalypse plus Microsoft, are all West Coast American tech corporations. Collectively, these five winner-take-all technology companies, the Frightful Five, according to the New York Times technology writer Farhad Manju, which together employ a little over 500,000 people, are worth around $2.3 trillion. If they were a country, this would rank them as the seventh largest economy in the world, a couple of $100 billion ahead of the annual GDP of India, with its more than 1.2 billion inhabitants. The personal wealth of the founders of these companies is equally astounding. The nine richest tech billionaires in Silicon Valley have a collective wealth that is more than that of 1.8 billion of the world's poorest people, a quarter of the world's entire population. It is obscene for so much wealth to be held in the hands of so few when one in 10 people survives on less than $2 a day, noted Oxfam's executive director, referring to the surreal chasm between a handful of Silicon Valley entrepreneurs and the rest of the world. This obscenity has a more local context, too. In impoverished East Palo Alto, the neighboring town to Palo Alto, the home of Stanford University and the epicenter of Silicon Valley, more than one-third of the school children are homeless. And part of the problem is that the economic gains of smart technology aren't trickling down to the rest of us. Silicon Valley's abundance of capital might even be compounding scarcity elsewhere. The people problem, if anything, might be getting worse. As the Columbia University economist Jeffrey Sachs told me about our two nations world, something is going on in national income distribution which is connected to the smart machine. Sachs is concerned that technology that improves technology might be making people worse off. There is truth to the idea that machines can take jobs and even lower our quality of life, he explained to me. It's the shift in the distribution of wealth from labor to capital that really worries the economist. And it's certainly not Luddite to have these forebodings, he insisted. Sachs acknowledges that the same debate has been raging for the past 200 years, ever since James Watt invented the steam engine and a combination of a mechanized textile industry and the development of railroads created the first industrial civilization. For 200 years, Sachs admits, we've been debating whether ever more powerful machines would enslave or empower us. But now, he insists, the question of the impact of smart technology on jobs is becoming urgent. What concerns him is that history is repeating itself in the sense that, as in the first blush of the Industrial Revolution, technology might be enlarging the economic pie, but is failing to establish a new prosperity shared by all. Sachs's concerns are increasingly shared by Silicon Valley notables, as well as by politicians traditionally sympathetic to the tech industry. Gavin Newsom, California's current lieutenant governor, has gone as far as to say that it's the job of Silicon Valley technologists to exercise their moral authority in fighting income inequality and job losses, which he describes as a code red, a fire hose, a tsunami that is rapidly approaching us. The plumbing of the world is radically changing, Newsom said in 2017, rendering his own rousing version of Moore's Law to graduating computer science students at the University of California, Berkeley. Your job is to exercise your moral authority. It is to do the kinds of things that can't be downloaded. A World Bank study, World Development Report 2016, Digital Dividends, also suggests that the digital revolution may be widening inequality and hollowing out middle-class jobs. This report shows that the supposed dividends of higher growth, more jobs, and public services from the digital revolution have fallen short of expectations. The research project, co-chaired by the then Estonian president, Tomas Hendrik Ilves, and the World Bank's chief economist, Kaushik Basu, found a global walled garden in which 60% of people in the world remain entirely excluded from the digital economy. Rapid digital expansion, the report's authors warned, has been skewed towards the wealthy, skilled, and influential around the world, who are better positioned to take advantage of the new technologies. It's the winner-take-all network, a two-nation digital universe writ large. Can the Internet save the world? Asks the New York Times about this 2016 World Bank report. The answer, for the moment, at least, is no. But how can the Internet, as what Gavin Newsom calls the plumbing for our new 21st century operating system, actually help save the world? As I suggested at the beginning of this chapter, the future sometimes appears in the unlikeliest of places. And the European country that is pioneering a better digital society by combining free market innovation with equally creative regulatory and educational reforms in order to put people back in the center of the digital map is the little Baltic Republic of Estonia, or E-Stonia, as Tomas Hendrik Ilves, its digitally savvy former president, calls it. So let's return to Estonia, where stuff happens first. Chapter 4. Utopia. A Case Study. Book 1. A Country in the Cloud. Fortunately, not everyone in Estonia is as miserable as Jan Tallinn. Indeed, the day after I hear his lecture about the end of the world, I spend the day in Tallinn meeting some of the remarkable policymakers who are cheerfully transforming the little Baltic Republic from a backward Soviet colony into the next Silicon Valley. Figuring out how to get around the Estonian capital is easy, if you have a map, that is, or at least some mental geography of the journey. We may have Waze, Google Maps, and the other GPS-powered travel apps on our smartphones, but we still need to physically transport ourselves by train, cab, or foot from one place to another to reach our destination. There are no super-intelligent teleportation machines on the technological horizon. Not even in high-tech Estonia. Geography, as one world traveler reminds us, continues to matter. And the first law of geography, another leading geographer explains, is that everything is related to everything else. There are few places in the world where geography has mattered in the past more than in Estonia, the country with the ill fortune to share a border with Russia and a sea with Denmark, Sweden, and Germany. Regional powers that have all, over the last half millennium, been rather too related to the little Baltic Republic. And yet, in spite of Estonia's unfortunate geography, or perhaps because of it, this land of just 28,000 square miles is today, with South Korea, Israel, Singapore, and its Scandinavian neighbors, one of the most wired and innovative countries on the planet. The government and people of Estonia are trying to invent the ideal information society. They are figuring out how to live well in cyberspace. Estonia is indeed an e-society with an e-state and an e-government that is reimagining cyberspace as civic space, from its e-residency program to its focus on the Internet in schools to the idea of government as a service. Estonians embrace life in the digital world. The New York Times tells us about a society that, it says, lives first and foremost online. The Baltic Republic is one of the most Internet-dependent countries in the world, explains the BBC. Estonia, adds The Atlantic, has the world's most tech-savvy government. No, geography isn't always destiny, not at least in Estonia. The Canadian new media guru Douglas Coupland suggests that in today's networked economy, your brand is your border. But Estonia's remarkable achievement has been to build a digital brand that is significantly more expansive than its analog borders. That's because we are running a country in the cloud, said Estonia's chief technology officer, Taavi Kotka, when I visited him at his little office just off Tallinn's Town Hall Square, the 11th century Gothic heart of the old town. Indeed, as the first country in the world to offer e-residency, an electronic passport that offers any small business person the right to use legitimate Estonian legal or accounting online services and digital technologies, Estonia is even trying to disrupt the age-old intimacy between physical territory and citizenship. This e-residency program underwrites online identity by establishing fingerprints, biometrics, and a private key on a chip. The goal of the program, its 28-year-old director, Kaspar Korjus, tells me, is to have 10 million e-residents citizens by 2025. That's almost 8 times the number of Estonia's current population of 1.3 million. Korjus wants to create what he calls a trust economy for business people around the world. The e-residency program is a well-lit antithesis to the dark web, the digital hell infested with drug and arms dealers, pedophiles, and other criminals. We want to be the Switzerland of the digital world, Korjus explains. Taavi Kotka is more ambitious. We are becoming the Matrix, the Estonian CTO tells me without smiling. Visit Estonia before Estonia visits you, as one t-shirt on sale at the airport said. The Estonian government puts it slightly more circumspectly. Moving toward the idea of a country without borders is how it describes this audacious e-residency scheme. It's an example of outsourcing government, Kotka explains. Given its unforgiving climate and inconvenient geography, Estonia has always struggled to find physical residents, he explains. So, e-residency creates a platform for a new global kind of citizenship. Not only, therefore, is Estonia running a government in the cloud, it is also trying to create a country in the cloud, a 21st century distributed community of people united by networked services rather than by geography. It's Kotka's Matrix, a country operating in the infinite realm of cyberspace. Not surprisingly, innovation tourists like myself flock to see this country without borders, where stuff happens first. This Baltic state is, according to Alec Ross, Hillary Clinton's digital guru while she was Secretary of State, and a keen student of Estonian innovation, the little country that could. With an entire economy that seems to be an e-economy, Estonia is, Ross promises, a country of the future, so naturally rich in digital innovation that its citizens are producing startups, like Jan Tallinn's Skype and Kazaa, that make Silicon Valley green with envy. Ross contrasts Estonia with another prisoner of geography, nearby Belarus, which has totally stagnated as a parochial command economy. While Estonia opened up, Ross concludes, Belarus closed off. The first law of geography might be that everything is related to everything else, but in 2017, the first law of Estonia is that practically everything and everyone is connected to the Internet. And so, 91.4% of Estonia's 1.3 million citizens are Internet users. 87.9% of its households have computers. 86.7% of Estonians have access to broadband, and 88.4% of them use it regularly. In neighboring Latvia, by contrast, only 76% of its citizens are Internet users, while in Russia, Estonia's former colonial ruler, that number is just 71%. Yet digital access alone, as then-President Ilves warned in the World Bank report, is an insufficient strategy for realizing transformational change. To build a genuinely networked society, he insisted, a country needs a mix of regulation, legislation, innovation, and education. The experience of Estonia shows that Internet access alone is not enough to reap the benefits of digital development, as most work has to be done at the level of state governance, legislation, and education, Ilves told a Washington, D.C. audience at the launch of the World Bank report in January 2016. The education system has played a particularly important role in improving the skills of people in Estonia, Ilves explained. This indeed was the first step in the Estonian revolution. By the late 1990s, a government-backed investment fund was paying for access of all schools to the Internet, as well as teaching computer programming skills to kids as young as 7. It's like literacy, one software engineer told me, describing the way essential programming skills are now viewed within schools. The Estonian educational system is also being redesigned to make people more responsible citizens. As Kristel Rillo, who runs e-services at the Ministry of Education, explains, Estonian schools now have obligatory programs called digital competence. The country is even planning a national test for digital competency in 5 areas, including the correct use of netiquette. Education is 2 steps ahead of the labor market, Rillo tells me, adding that kids are turning out to be 2 steps ahead of middle-aged workers in learning how to become digital citizens. Trust, trust, trust. But the most intriguing step in Estonia's digital development has taken place outside the classroom. The key to the Estonian digital revolution is an identity card system that puts digital identity and trust at the heart of a new social contract. The mandatory electronic ID card, currently used by more than 95% of Estonians, gives everyone a secure online identity and offers a platform for digital citizenship featuring more than 4,000 online services, including the storage of health and police records, paying taxes, and voting. This online ID system is an attempt, explains Andres Kut, the chief architect of the Estonian Information System Authority, to redefine the nature of the country by getting rid of bureaucracy and reinventing government as what he calls a service. As one of the principal architects of this new system, Kut aims to integrate everyone's data into a single, easy-to-navigate information portal. Kut, a recent MIT graduate and former Skype employee, says that Estonia wants to smash bureaucratic silos and distribute power down to the citizens so that government comes to them rather than their having to go to the government. I meet Kut in his government office on the top floor of a rundown building hidden behind a strip mall. Dressed in a green knitted sweater, he's a small man with a wispy beard and an unashamedly hobbit-like enthusiasm for the ambitious technology he is building. "The old model is broken. We are changing the concept of citizenship," he says by way of explaining what he calls government as a service. "This technology creates trust. It's transparent. All agencies can access this data, but citizens have the right to know if their data has been accessed. In the old world, citizens were dependent on government. In Estonia, we are trying to make government dependent on citizens." The ID system Kut is designing is supposed to be the reverse of Orwell's Big Brother. In Estonia, citizens are being empowered to watch the operations of government. And although the government can look at people's data, it must notify them when it does so. Kut gives me a personal anecdote of how the system works. He had driven to a lecture in Tallinn to demonstrate the ID system. When he looked at his data, he saw that a police officer had accessed his information 30 minutes earlier. Following up in his online records, he found that an unmarked police car had followed his car on the road to Tallinn because his license plate was dirty. The police accessed his records, checked his driver's license, and decided not to stop him. The point of this story, Kut reminds me, is to stress the accountability of government in this new citizen database system. "Nothing can be done secretly," he insists. "It's a transparent system designed to protect individual rights and compound the trust between citizens and their government." Everyone I spoke to in Estonia, from startup entrepreneurs to policymakers to technologists to government ministers, agreed with Kut that the most important aspect of the ID system is the creation of trust. It's like that old real estate cliche about the 3 most important qualities of a house. Location, location, location. Likewise, the 3 most important things about the Estonian ID system are trust, trust, and trust. Given what the 2017 Edelman Trust Barometer described as the implosion of trust in the world today, this makes the Estonian experiment relevant for all of us. Estonians trust their government. Merle Megre, the country's security policy chief, promises me. "Everything relies on trust in digital society," explains the country's CTO, Taavi Kotka. Estonia, adds Kasper Korjus, the director of the e-residency program, is developing what he calls the trust economy. "And the government," Korjus explains, "is the only institution that can credibly underwrite trust for the whole community." Sten Tomkivi, a startup internet entrepreneur who formed Estonia's first digital advertising company in 1996, while he was still in high school, and sold it later to the global agency DDB Worldwide, describes the ID system as a trust mechanism. Tomkivi tells me that while it might be mandatory, your data is yours. You get to see who looks at your records, he says. And reiterating what everyone else told me, only the government can access personal data in a system that has been designed to be so transparent that individuals are notified whenever the authorities access it. Ain Aviksu, Deputy Secretary General for E-Services and Innovation at the Ministry of Social Affairs, and part of the team that built Estonia's first health portal, also sees this new system as compounding trust. The Estonian people trust the system because they haven't seen misuse. This system gives people the ability to determine their own privacy, but they have to take responsibility, he tells me. According to Sim Sikut, a Princeton-educated technologist who is now an advisor to the Estonian president, this national ID system ensures that you really are who you claim to be. Like the e-residency scheme, it authorizes identity, Sikut explains. And the only person who has full access to your data is you. After all, if you can't trust your government, Sikut asks rhetorically, then who exactly can you trust? Estonian trust in government is, in fact, much higher than the EU average. A 2014 Eurobarometer study found that 51% of Estonians trust their government, in contrast with the EU average of 29%. But while Estonians' trust in their government is high, the study found that only 13% of Estonians trusted their political parties. Given Estonia's commitment to reinventing government as an online service, this sharp disparity between people's trust for government and their trust for political parties can be explained by the success of their digital reforms. Estonian people don't trust government, but they do trust e-government, explains Linar Vik, another of the architects of the ID card infrastructure and a serial tech entrepreneur dubbed by the press Estonia's Mr. Internet. I ask Vik to explain the technology behind the ID system that can guarantee trust. It is, Estonia's Mr. Internet tells me, public infrastructure built with asymmetric, distributed technology, containing digital signature architecture with a timestamp. What this means, in simpler language, is that the information entered into the system can't be altered or even looked at unless the owner of the data is alerted. The medical or financial or criminal records in the system are therefore guaranteed to be trustworthy. They can't be secretly tampered with or spied upon. Vik describes this as blockchain before blockchain. Blockchain, by the way, is new technology that enables the creation of a public database that can't be tampered with or altered. According to the Canadian futurists Don and Alex Tapscott, this blockchain technology, which they call the Trust Protocol, could be the most significant technological development since the invention of the Internet. So what Vik means by his blockchain before blockchain comment is that while the Estonian ID system doesn't contain formal blockchain technology, it nonetheless has a similar impact, creating what The Economist, in describing blockchain, called a trust machine, the great chain of being sure about things. As always with new things, the technological details of this process are less interesting than its political and economic consequences. And there are some extremely significant potential consequences of the Estonian government's entry into the data business. According to Vik, one result might be a new type of rivalry between sovereign governments and Silicon Valley's private superpowers. Governments aren't realizing that they're losing the digital identities of their citizens to American companies like Google, Facebook, Amazon, and Apple, Vik explains. And they are waking up to the realization that they have a responsibility to protect the privacy of these citizens. It's personal data, of course, that has made these private superpowers so wealthy and powerful. And though the ID system of course doesn't stop Estonians from using Facebook or Google, the database is designed as a rival kind of ecosystem. a secure public alternative designed to benefit citizens rather than private corporations. Veeck, like BetaWorks CEO John Borthwick, argues that one of today's great challenges is to reinvent the relevance of government in the new digital world. And it's here, he believes, that the longer-term significance of the ID system may lie. The government's role is to protect the privacy of its citizens, Veeck says, about this Estonian government policy of underwriting personal data. It's an extension of public infrastructure, the 21st century version of the welfare state. To some readers, particularly those like Edward Snowden who cherish their privacy, this ID system, with its radical transparency, might sound a little dystopian. But one of the unavoidable consequences of the digital revolution is the massive explosion of personal data on the network. Like it or not, this data is only going to grow exponentially with the development of smart homes, smart cars, smart cities, and above all the other smart objects driving the Internet of Things. We don't have a choice about any of this. But what we do have a choice about is the amount of transparency we demand of the governments or corporations that have access to our personal data. That's why Veeck's attempt to create a blockchain-like transparency within the Estonian government's database of information about its citizens is so important. It may not be an ideal solution, but outside of utopia, this Estonian model is probably about as good as we are going to get. Speaking of utopia, perhaps it should come as no surprise that in Thomas More's little 16th century book, the island of Utopia was organized on transparent principles similar to those in 21st century Estonia. In Utopia, there is nothing private anywhere, with people even being able to go into somebody else's house and snoop around if they felt like it. Things were indeed so open in Utopia that there was a custom that husbands and wives, before marriage, would be required to inspect each other naked to make sure they knew exactly what they were getting in the transaction. And so, 500 years after Thomas More wrote about that transparent no-place founded by King Eutropus, we now have Utopia. But unlike More's 16th century fantasy, 21st century Estonia can be found on a map. It even boasts a real-life version of Eutropus, the tech-savvy Tomas Hendrik Ilves, the Estonian president between 2006 and 2016. Utopus. The presidential palace and Kadriorg Park couldn't be more different from the Tallinn Science Park building where I spoke with Jan Tallinn at the Machine Learning Estonia meetup. This palace is an ornate early 20th century building situated in a tree-lined private park near the cobbled streets of the old town. It is designed to resemble the early 18th century Kadriorg Palace, a frilly, Baroque building that was commissioned by Peter the Great for his wife, Catherine. Kadriorg means Catherine's Valley in Estonian, after the successful Russian siege of Tallinn in 1710. The difference between Estonia's two most famous technocrats, Tomas Hendrik Ilves and Jan Tallinn, is equally dramatic. In contrast with the reticent and diminutive Tallinn, President Ilves, the country's most powerful legislator, is a robust man with a media-ready voice and the colorful manner of an intellectual showman. He's wearing the dapper uniform of blazer, dress shirt, and bow tie to match. And while Tallinn keeps his private life intensely private, Ilves's 100,000 Twitter followers can keep track of everything he does, including the details of his three high-profile marriages and his various offspring. The country without borders, it seems, has a president without borders. Sitting across the table from me in one of the palace's formal dining rooms, Ilves tells me the story of his life. Technology provides the thread to his narrative. Born in 1953 in Stockholm to Estonian refugees who had fled the post-war Soviet occupation, Ilves grew up in New Jersey, where he was both an academic prodigy and an early computer geek. He boasts that he learned to program as a 13-year-old and that he owned an Apple IIe personal computer, the immediate predecessor to the Macintosh. He earned undergraduate and graduate degrees in psychology from Columbia University and the University of Pennsylvania, and then, as a radio journalist, ran the Estonian desk at the Munich-based Radio Free Europe. When Estonia, which he reminds me was very poor, became independent in August 1991, he'd asked himself rhetorically, "What do we have here?" "Good math skills," he'd answered. "That's what we have." Under the Soviet occupation, Ilves explains, Little Estonia had had the good fortune of being used as a kind of research and development lab for advanced technology. And so, unlike those in other East European countries colonized by the Soviets, Estonia's universities hadn't been ransacked, and its population, including gifted young technologists, like the 19-year-old Jan Tallinn, remained among the best educated in Eastern Europe. Estonia's future, therefore, Ilves concluded, would be high tech. Much of this was inspired, he tells me, by what he calls a backward reading of Jeremy Rifkin's influential book, The End of Work, which predicted the decline of the workforce in a post-industrial age. What Ilves took, however, from Rifkin's thesis is the counterintuitive idea that small countries like Estonia could actually benefit from the great transformation from an industrial to an information economy. Size would matter in the future, too, he figured. But while the 20th century naturally advantaged industrial leviathans, like the Soviet Union, with their massive economies of scale and millions of industrial laborers, the networked age could favor small startup nations, like Estonia, with its small, highly skilled workforce that could speedily pivot around new technologies. The future, Ilves correctly predicted, would belong to countries nimble enough to perpetually reinvent themselves in our age of constant change. It would also belong to nimble people, like Ilves himself. After the country gained independence in 1991, Ilves successfully reinvented himself, pivoting from radio journalism to Estonian politics. In 1993, he was appointed Estonian ambassador to the United States. From 1996 to 1998 and 1999 to 2002, he was the Estonian Minister of Foreign Affairs. In 2004, he became a member of the European Parliament. Then, in 2006, he was elected by Estonia's parliament as the country's fourth president, a five-year post he has held twice. As a public servant over the last quarter century, he has led the transformation of Estonia from a forgotten northwestern province of the Soviet Union into a hub of high-tech innovation. Ilves is a personification, albeit a rather noisy and self-confident one, of Moore's Law. He helped pioneer the computerization of schools, as well as the establishment of internet centers and public Wi-Fi all around Estonia. He has led the investment in such infrastructure as the Ternopil campus, with more than 400 tech startups in Tallinn Science Park. He has helped with the digitalization of Estonian public records and books so that, in case of another Russian occupation, not inconceivable given that relations with a revanchist Moscow are increasingly tense, this data will remain safe. One of his most cherished accomplishments is the e-residency program, which offers non-Estonians digital citizenship. And through his high-profile work with such international organizations as the World Bank and the World Economic Forum, the colorful Ilves has certainly made sure that Little Estonia appears to the outside world as a country without boundaries. Ilves's major legacy lies, however, in his pioneering work with what he calls digital identity and trust. The role of the sovereign in a digital society, he explains to me, is to guarantee identity. I remember Edward Snowden's speech at the Alte Teppich Fabrik. "What does it mean when we are all transparent and have no secrets anymore?" Snowden had asked the Berlin audience. The answer, he suggested, was the undermining of individual freedom and of the other verities of the self, as articulated by liberals like Samuel Warren and Louis Brandeis. So, for Snowden, the role of the sovereign is very simple. It's to keep out of our online business, to allow us to maintain our individual autonomy, to leave us alone. Ilves's notion of guaranteeing identity sounds much too intrusive for a privacy advocate like Edward Snowden. So, I raise the Snowden question with Ilves Is Snowden a heroic leaker or traitorous hacker? Ilves is much too wily a political fox to fall into the trap of defining Snowden as either. What he does tell me, however, is that the NSA contractor, now exiled somewhere in Russia, was wrong to be so obsessed with our privacy from government agencies. Snowden, he says, created a paranoid shitstorm over his revelations about the NSA, even though most of these revelations were, in Ilves's opinion, either completely misunderstood or inaccurate. Rather than reading bohemian poets' emails to their girlfriends, he says, the NSA, in its legitimate search for terrorists, was simply using the metadata to look at who is connecting to who. Our obsession with privacy is misguided, Ilves insists, wagging his finger at me so insistently from across the table that I worry his bow tie might spin off. The real issue is data integrity. It's not that Ilves is completely dismissing the significance of privacy or diminishing its importance as a component of individual freedom, but the real issue for government in an internet world where data about everything and everyone is readily accessible on Google, he says, is refereeing a system where that data is authentic. He is saying that there's nothing more important than data integrity in a digital 21st century where everything, including ourselves, is turned into information. And so the role of government is to create a trustworthy informational exchange system that is secure. If data is indeed the new currency of the networked age, then it requires what he calls a sovereign guarantee. Like currency, it has value only if it has this official stamp of authenticity. Somebody knowing my blood type isn't a big deal, he explains. But if they could change the data on my blood type, that could kill me. The real problem, he adds, lowering his voice, is when somebody starts fiddling with the data. The specter of online surveillance, therefore, worries him much less than that of data corruption. And this explains why so much time and so many resources in Estonia have been invested in its second brain, the online ID system. This platform, Ilves reminds me, creates ways to exchange data that are completely secure. Your data is yours, as Sten Tomkivi assured me. But the information is really yours in Estonia only if the government is ensuring that nobody is tampering with it. The greatest service, then, of government as a service is establishing data integrity. The role of the sovereign in the digital 21st century, Ilves insists, is to guarantee our identity. He calls this a Lockean contract, and described it to me as the new social contract for digital times.
Given that the original Lockean contract underpinning Anglo-American representative democracy operates on a series of mutual obligations between the government and its citizens, I wonder about the equivalent obligations for our digital age.
So, what's our responsibility in this new social contract, I ask? If the government guarantees the integrity of the data, what do citizens need to guarantee in exchange? It's a fully transparent system, Ilves explains. Just as it keeps government honest, he says, so it also keeps us honest. The government can, if it needs to, examine our data. So we all have to take responsibility for our own online behavior. In the information-rich democracy being constructed in Estonia, he suggests, there can be no digital anonymity. Everything people do, from paying taxes online, to ordering medicine, to posting opinions, to driving cars, is done under their own names. So, for example, Estonian newspapers are connecting the ID system to their bulletin boards, making it impossible to comment anonymously. This new social contract does away with the trolls who have made the internet such a barbaric place, and it makes people accountable for the spreading of fake news, racism and sexism, spiteful rumors, and the other antisocial behavior seemingly endemic in digital culture. Our goal is to make it impossible to do bad things without consequences. We want to teach people to be good on the internet, to use it responsibly, he says, sounding a little like a headmaster. I remember that Estonia is planning to establish a national-level test in schools to measure digital competency. I wonder if civic responsibility might be part of this exam. In a way, of course, this is all very chilling, especially to people like Edward Snowden, who lionize individual privacy. It doesn't escape me that we are having this conversation in a replica of an 18th-century palace built by Peter the Great, the Russian conqueror of Estonia, in honor of his wife Catherine. Given Estonia's history of being ruled by supposedly enlightened despots, such as Peter and Catherine the Great, not to mention Stalin, the country is all too familiar with the dangers of state control. The Estonian ID operating system, with its guarantee of identity, is in contrast a mutually transparent system. What Ilves describes as a new social contract is based on the rights of both government and citizens to observe each other. The watching is done with full transparency within a comprehensive legal framework that requires the authorities to alert people if they look at their data. It's an architecture of trust designed for what Andreas Weigand, the former chief scientist of Amazon, calls our post-privacy world. Moore's Outlaws. So, what to make of Estonia? Does this country without borders offer a preview of our 21st century fate? Stuff might happen first in Estonia, but will it happen everywhere else next? Perhaps. The Estonian model does come, however, with three important caveats. First, it's important to remember the country's ahistorical exceptionalism. Like other startup nations, such as Israel, and, as we shall see, Singapore, Estonia has been able to reinvent itself because of its good fortune in being able to stand outside history. Just as Israel began in 1948 without any legacy institutions or traditions, so the post-1991 Estonian digital revolution occurred because a new generation of technologically literate policymakers and politicians, the Radio Free Europe journalist Ilves and his Princeton and MIT-educated cadre of entrepreneurs and programmers, filled the vacuum created by the retreating colonial Soviet bureaucracy. Everything changed overnight. August 1991 marked the beginning of year one in modern Estonian history. Second, there is the distinctively unexceptional nature of the Estonian economy. Ilves, you'll remember, told me that Estonia was a very poor country when, in August 1991, the Soviets left. But even today, it remains a relatively underdeveloped place, especially in comparison with advanced post-industrial economies like the United States, Germany, or Singapore. Estonia might top the trust league, but it doesn't lead the world in much else. A tech mega-billionaire, a Zuckerberg or a Bezos, could probably buy Little Estonia outright if he wanted. Its per capita GDP of around $17,600, for example, is ranked 42nd in the world, slightly above middle-rank economies like Russia and Turkey, but a third of Singapore's $52,900, and the average monthly wage after taxes of its workforce of 675,000 is under 1,000 euros. So, reports of Estonia as the next Silicon Valley are, to be polite, slightly exaggerated. Ilves is under no delusions about this. While he believes the Estonian government as a service experiment is scalable, he acknowledges that it is more suited as a model for developing countries, such as India, rather than for advanced democracies. And the third caveat is separating its appearance from its reality. All the policymakers and legislators with whom I spoke, from the green-jerseyed Andres Kut to Linar Vik, the country's Mr. Internet, have, in the best Silicon Valley fashion, drunk the Kool-Aid, and thus loudly proclaimed the triumph of their country in a cloud. But the truth is less triumphant. This revolution remains a work in progress, and many ordinary Estonians remain indifferent to a lot of these digital abstractions. Nonetheless, Estonia does matter.
It matters because the government is prioritizing what Tomas Hendrik Ilves calls data integrity, the rather prim-sounding issue that will surely come to dominate conversations about 21st century politics.
It matters because Estonia is creating a model of digital government that is the antithesis of the one being created by its antagonist, Vladimir Putin's Russian Federation. His vast eastern neighbor is never far from the Estonian president's mind. Between 1945 and 1946, Ilves reminds me, the Soviets brutally occupied the country and destroyed 10 million Estonian books in an effort to completely obliterate the indigenous culture. And now Putin's Russia preoccupies Ilves. When, for example, I inquire about the purpose of the Estonian Secret Service, he explains that its goal is to track down Russian spies. And while he acknowledges that the immediate threat of a Russian invasion of Estonia has receded since the cyber attack that changed the world, Web War I, the notorious Russian cyber invasion of 2007, when Russian hackers shut down the Estonian internet, he certainly doesn't dismiss the threat of another invasion from the East, virtually or otherwise. Which is why, he explains, the Estonian government is digitizing all the country's books and written records and shipping them out of the country. And it's why, he adds, smiling grimly, we are in NATO. Rather than xenophobia or a desire for historical vengeance, however, Ilves's hostility to contemporary Russia is rooted in his profound distaste for a new category of government that Putin is pioneering. It's a 21st century type of dictatorship, he explains, that has grown out of what Ilves dubs the post-truth philosophy of French postmodernists like Jacques Derrida and Jean Baudrillard. Orchestrated by Vladislav Surkov, Putin's personal advisor, and according to the Anglo-Russian writer Peter Pomerantsev, the hidden author of Putinism, it's a style of government intent on transforming politics into a tightly produced reality television show of innuendo, gossip, and menacing unreality. Surkov's Putinism, not unlike in many ways the Trumpist spectacle produced by Stephen Bannon and Breitbart News in the United States, transforms politics into a real-time, always-on war of misinformation and disinformation. It is a definitively untrustworthy operation, run, to borrow some words from the Russian opposition leader Alexei Navalny, by a party of crooks and thieves. And the Internet, with its absence of curatorial authority and the anonymity of many of its users, has become the ideal medium for orchestrating this new type of war against truth. The real problem, Ilves warned me, is when somebody starts fiddling with the data. That's the essence of Putinism, fiddling with the data. Russia, explains Peter Pomerantsev, reinvents reality, creating mass hallucinations that then translate into political action. And this reinvention of reality relies on fiddling with the facts, particularly the digital facts, because outside of the kind of meticulously secure system developed for Estonia's ID, they are so easy to manipulate, so easy to fake, so simple to turn upside down and transform into lies. The British historian Simon Schama tweeted that indifference about the distinction between truth and lies is the precondition of fascism. When truth perishes, so does freedom. Putin's whole operating system, with its reliance on opacity, fakery, and lies, is a metastasized kind of fascism. The Russian state is making a massive investment in the machinery of digital untruth as the main vehicle, a kind of digital ministry of truth, of its domestic and foreign policy. More than that, it has set up a 4-story office complex in St. Petersburg as the headquarters of Russia's troll army, the hundreds, maybe even thousands of bloggers paid by Putin to lie on the Internet about everything from Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump to the war in Ukraine. The Kremlin sponsors the online harassment of anyone who tries to expose these trolls and has, according to the New York Times, hired elite hackers and made cyber warfare a central tenet of expanding its interests overseas. Russia spends $300 million annually on a cyber army of 1,000 hackers, which according to the Financial Times is known as APT-28, and also goes under the name of Fancy Bears Hack Team. It has been held responsible for interfering with the 2016 U.S. presidential election. Things have got so bad in this onslaught of fake news that in 2015, the European Union set up East Stratcom, its own 11-person team to defend the continent against fake news. Recent online lies have included the Swedish government's support of the Islamic State.